speak to the spider, I live. Existing, I do not exist among the people. And enjoyment is my renunciation. And association, detachment. I have broken all bonds and ligatures. What's a ligature?
Ties. Isn't that what Marvel said yesterday?
A tie.
Yeah. What kind of tie?
Windsor, right?
What?
Who's writing this?
Tukaram.
Oh, Tukaram.
Is it attachment tie?
Of course, we're talking about that, but I thought... Tukka says, I'm not what I appear to be. Ask Panduranga if you have anything to ask. Don't ask me. The Swami Vivekananda Birth Centenary by Arthur Osborne. It is hard to remember to what a low ebb Hinduism had fallen at the advent of Sri Ramakrishna. The Hindus, conquered by a Western country, recognizing its more potent civilization, adopting its education, began to feel dejected at home and despised abroad. Missionaries were not wanting to proclaim that the West's superiority was due to Christianity and India's backwardness to Hinduism. With the Brahmo Samaj, a Christianized version of Hinduism was offered by Western-influenced Hindus. The rigidly Orthodox were already outside the current of history, and the moderates were inclined to compromise. Then the presence of Sri Ramakrishna electrified Bengal. Almost uneducated, writing no books, proclaiming no philosophy, by the sheer power of his presence, he changed the whole tone of things. Those who were being swept on the current of reformism and agnosticism, like the young Narendra Dutt himself, were arrested and shocked back into devotion. Nevertheless, it was still necessary to vocalize and spread this new influence to create a respect for Hinduism in the West and a self-respect in India. You know, before he died, he did a little right. In front of Narendra, Vivekananda.
Mm-hmm.
He put him into like a samadhi state and he sprinkled some water or something like that. And he said, now I'm a beggar. All my powers are gone. I've given everything.
To Vivekananda.
Given to you and you will teach the world. You know? He said, no, I won't. He said, your bones will make you do it. Your very bones will make you teach. These were the two tasks into which Narendra became now Swami Vivekananda, flung himself with his colossal energy, and by and large he succeeded. If some of his books for Westerners now seem elementary, if Hindus seem conscious enough of their great cultural heritage, that does not mean that his task was unnecessary. On the contrary, it is a measure of his success, of the vast change that has come about since his work began. There was no doubt about the grace that flowed through him. At the famous Chicago Parliament of Religious, famous now only because Vivekananda took part in it, it was not his arguments that impressed people so much as his presence. He had got no farther than Sisters and Brothers of America. That's the first thing he said, when he started his first lecture there. When the entire hall burst in a torrent of applause, from that point on, in speech after speech, contact after contact, people felt the power and grace in him. A recently published book by some 30-odd disciples and admirers, Hindu and Western, shows this overpowering impression he made on people and the support they derived from him. It shows, too, how he retained his simplicity and humor despite their adulation, never falling a victim to pride. No wonder, then, that Vivekananda is honored in India as a national, no less than a religious hero. Indeed, India and Hinduism are traditionally so closely united that it is sometimes hard to separate the two. In 1963, the Swami's birth centenary was being celebrated throughout India. Books were published on the occasion, lectures given, meetings held. The enthusiasm was enormous. The celebrations overflowed into 1964, culminating this year in Calcutta and Madras. They show what a powerful hold the Swami still has on the imagination and loyalty of his compatriots. Naga Baba by S.P. Mukherjee. Naga Baba, who died only a few years ago, was a very aged Swami, living in a small ashram on a low hill at Puri. None knew his name or provenance. He was referred to simply as Naga Baba, Naga meaning naked, since he wore not even a loincloth. People merely guessed his age, some of the guesses running into centuries. His manner was abrupt. He did not encourage people to visit him often or to stay long. Typically, crabbed was his answer when someone asked him his age. If you think I am a fool enough to identify myself with this body, you are a fool to come here. When a visitor had been sitting in his presence for some 20 minutes or so, he was quite likely to say, "Well, you have had darshan. You can go now. Get out." And yet, people went to him, and they felt a strange euphoria, even an exhilaration in his presence, and carried away with them. S.P. Mukherjee, who was an engineer in a large Calcutta firm, retired in 1960 while Naga Baba was still living, and settled down with his wife at Tiruvannamalai, building a house near the ashram. I've been to his house, near the Agni Tirtham. Neither of them had ever seen the Maharshi, but they had immense devotion and felt his guidance. Mr. Mukherjee tells the following story. His grandson was a big devotee, by the way, Mr. Mukherjee, from a Naino or something. In 1952, I visited Naga Baba with a whole group of my family and relations. We sat for some time in his presence, but he simply ignored us, did not even look at us. We were staying at a large hotel in the town. That night I could not sleep. Towards morning I felt restless and went downstairs to the lounge. The air was hot and oppressive. Altogether I felt ill at ease. Suddenly I had an impulse to go and see the Swami then and there. I found a rickshaw waiting outside the hotel and went. When I arrived at about 4 o'clock in the morning, I found the Swami sitting alone under a neem tree and had an impression that he was waiting for me. I sat down in front of him, feeling glad to be alone with him, not in a crowd. He smiled and spoke to me in a very friendly tone, saying, "So, you have come back." That showed that he had noticed me earlier in the day. Though he seemed not to, I felt happy and at ease in his presence, and asked him a few questions that were troubling me, beginning with some reference to the course of my life. The first was, when should I begin to lead a life of sadhana? quest? He replied simply, no. I explained to him the circumstances were very difficult at present. My daughter was not yet married. My contract with my firm was not renewed. I was engaged in litigation and had a variety of worries. But he simply answered that was the best time. I next asked him whether I should retire in a few years before completing my service. And he said, yes. Then without mentioning Arunachala by name, I asked him whether I should settle down and make sadhana in an ashram at the foot of a hill to which I was strongly drawn. He closed his eyes for a few moments, and then opened them and said, yes, you will do that. After that, I asked him a more profound question. How shall I get rid of my ahankara, ego sense? He said, what ego sense? What ego? I told him that it was nothing specific, but everything I do. For instance, if I do something well, I feel proud. I have a sense of being a better person. He said, that is egoism of the mind. You'll get rid of it if you control your mind and start recoiling it into its source. It is like a person flying a kite. As he recoils the thread, the kite flies over a smaller and smaller range till at last it comes to rest and stops flying altogether. After sitting silent for a few minutes, but with no strength, no sense of constraint, he spoke again, saying, but in a kind and gracious way, well, have you had enough now? So I took leave of him and went away, feeling peaceful and elated.
So where was this Naga Baba?
Puri.
Huh?
Near Puri.
Puri. The only place of the temple of Brahma.
Oh.
Puri.
We have a big article on vegetarianism by Arthur Osborne. I'll just read the opening line from the Lankavatara Sutra. The Bodhisattva, desirous of cultivating the virtue of love, should not eat meat, lest he cause terror to living beings. When dogs see, even at a distance, an outcast who likes eating meat, they are terrified and think, these are dealers of death and will kill us. Even the minute beings living in earth, air, and water have a very keen sense of smell and detect at a distance the odor of the demons and meat eaters, and they flee as fast as they can from death which threatens them. Is there any benefit from not eating meat? Or perhaps the question should be the other way around. Is there any harm in eating meat? I'm not considering the question from a medical, but purely from a spiritual point of view. One's body is not a mere tenement. So long as one remains an individual being, it is a part of that being, and as De La Mer quaintly remarks, it's a very strange thing, as strange as can be, that whatever Miss T eats turns into Miss T. So, are you going to go on? The Avadhuta Gita. Neither those who seek identity nor those who seek duality know their immutable essence, which is free from both. And Tukaram says, for him who has himself become God, all people are God. The Secrets of Arunachala by TKS. Skanda Purana.
TKS, TKS, what did it say?
That is a holy place. Of all, is the most sacred. It is the heart of the world. Know it to be the secret and sacred heart center of Shiva. In that place he always abides, is the glorious Aruna Hill. What is the mountain path? The mountain is Arunachala, and there are two paths, one to the summit and the other around the base. Arunachala shines as Paramatman, the Supreme Self, made manifest, the self of all creatures, not only men, but gods and heavenly beings. The same self was Bhagavan Ramana, who declared, Anamale is myself. This implies that he, being the self, is not any of the three bodies, gross, subtle, or causal, pertaining to the three states of waking, dream, and deep sleep, but is the self-aware witness of all three. In that supreme state, he is a screen on which the cinema show of name and form projected. He is also the light by which it is revealed, and the person who sees it. He is Arunachala, the self of all. We have seen him here on earth as Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, the great path maker. In the days when he lived in a cave on the hill, we used to climb only to where he was, Rilpaksha Cave, or the Mango Grove, or Skanda Ashramam, wherever it was, for he was both the path and the goal, and there was no other happiness comparable to being with him and absorbing the radiance of grace that flowed forth from him. On the path to the summit, starting from the northern Gopura, or tower, of the great temple, or from a small village opposite the hospital at the southeast of the hill, the first landmark is Guhai Namashivaya Cave. And above, the famous guru who had even more famous disciple known as Namashivaya. This disciple he sent to Chidambaram to found his own center. There the disciple became known as Guru Namashivaya, while his guru was called Guhaya Namashivaya. Proceeding farther, we come to Virupaksha Cave, which was already famous before Sri Ramana sanctified it by his abode. It is named after the great master Virupaksha, who lived there and who is said on death to have converted his body into a Vibhuti Lingam, a lingam of sacred ashes. There is a small shrine to him there. The cave is said to be in the form of Om, and it is said that sitting silent in it, one hears the sound of Om. Just above Virupaksha Cave, the Skanda Ashram, a more spacious cave, where Bhagavan moved after leaving Virupaksha. It was here that an ashram first grew up around him, with food being cooked and his mother presiding. The cave was built out to enlarge it. A spring was released, which since then has provided a perennial supply of water. Now it dries up. Yeah. Even a few trees were planted. The ashram now maintains Skanda Ashramam and keeps a caretaker there. And it is one of the places that devotees must visit. Someone used to stay there even at nights. But some ruffians came in and ransacked the place and beat them up and everything. So they stopped.
Now that Swami goes in the morning, right?
Yeah, the Brahmananda. But he doesn't go every day now.
Oh, he's not.
higher up, the path curves around to the east slope, and directly below the main peak are the seven springs and small crevices of a huge rock with a perennial storage of cool water, even in the hottest weather. I think all that is over. Just above them is a mound of boulders at the entrance to a deep, cool cave. Bhagavan often sat there with his devotees. Saints and rishis have lived there in the past. Have you seen that? Something? I've been there, yeah. From here up to the main peak is a steep climb, and indeed may take as long as the whole climb from Virupaksha to the seven springs. At last we reach the summit, where is a large flat stone with enormous rock-cut feet on it. It is here that the huge cauldron is placed every year at the festival of Kartikeya, about which I will write in the later article, when a beacon of ghee brought by devotees is lit, visible far around. What is the significance of the feet? Obviously, they are the feet of Arunachala. The feet are in the head. The feet are in the head of the mountain. I don't know. Because you go to the top and you find there the feet. Because in Arunachala, the Supreme, there is neither top nor bottom. There are no parts. There is just wholeness. Also because what is highest in principle is lowest in manifestation. The first is last, and the last is first. That's what Jesus said about his kingdom. He who is last among you will be first in my kingdom, or lowest among you. On the northern slope, far from the path, is a place where Arunagirishwara, the great Siddhapurusha, the spirit of Arunachala, abides under an enormous banyan tree. Seems like he knows the place. Abides under an enormous banyan tree. And it should be mentioned that it is this sage, God in the form of Arunachala, who is worshipped in the great temple in Thiruvannamalai. There is an ancient legend that anyone who can find his way to the eternal sage or spirit in his almost inaccessible abode will receive realization. Only Sri Ramana succeeded in doing so, and he already had realization. Can one see in it a symbol of the direct path of self-inquiry, which had been withdrawn from use in our spiritually dark age, and which Bhagavan Sri Ramana brought down from its inaccessible retreat to his ashram at the foot of the hill, making it accessible to all, so that none now need to seek the ancient Siddhapurusha? Bhagavan used to say that there were many paths to the peak. Indeed, he would scramble up to it from Skanda Ashramam, often following no path at all, and be down again in less than an hour's time. He used to speak also of caves in the hill, and of siddhas, or sages, with supernatural powers who lived there. There are legends of cities and gardens within the hill, and of great souls sitting in perpetual tapa seeking to attain the conscious identity with Lord Arunachala, which is Bhagavan's natural and permanent state. When someone asked him once whether all that does not exist only in the mind, he waved his hand around to indicate the physical phenomenal world of everyday existence and said, so does this. Strangely enough, more emphasis is laid on the path around the hill. Bhagavan always took an interest and looked pleased when devotees took this path, making pradakshina, as it is called. He would often ask what time they started, how long it took, at what places they rested by the way. Recently, Captain Taneja, a devotee from the Punjab, who never saw Bhagavan in his lifetime, had been making production night after night and intended next day to climb to the peak. But that night he dreamed that he was standing facing the hill, and a voice came forth from it saying, "Why should you go to the top? My fire is at the base." The 8-mile walk around the hill, going from east to west, that is to say, keeping the hill always on one's right, is a pilgrimage and is supposed to be made barefoot and at a slow pace, in a state of remembrance or meditation. It is said that whatever one wishes or prays for during the production is fulfilled. But it is also said that it is better not to wish, for this is a path to the desirelessness of the self. And every wish or prayer, however noble it may seem to be, is an affirmation of the limited pseudo-self who wishes, and thereby an obstacle to the realization of the desireless self. Production is often made at night, especially when the moon is full or nearly full, because for a large part of the year it is uncomfortably hot to go around by day. Most devotees start from the ashram nowadays silently seeking Bhagavan's grace before starting. According to the old Brahmin tradition, however, a Brahmin would start out after bathing in the Indra Tirtha, or tank, on the eastern side of the town. From there, he would proceed to the gates of the great temple, prostrate there, and walk slowly on, meditating on Lord Arunachala. Starting from the ashram also, one is expected to pass through the temple from one great gate to another, but on the way back, the 8 directions of space on the way around are marked by a monolithic stylized sacred bowl, a tank, and a Shiva Lingam. Sri Ramanashramam is at the southernmost point beside the mantapam of or diminutive chapel of Dakshinamurti. In Hindu mythology, Dakshinamurti, and one interpretation of the name of the southward facing, is Shiva manifested as a youth surrounded by elderly disciples and teaching them in silence. The Guru is the North Pole, and therefore traditionally faces south. Bhagavan was often equated with Dakshinamurti. Due west is the sacred tank and the lingam of Unnamalai, that is to say, of Uma, the consort of Shiva, who came down on earth to make tapas on Arunachala. This tapas was guided by the Rishi Gautama, whose ashram is just beside her tank. The myth is that Uma once in sport put her hands over the eyes of Shiva, thus closing them. This plunged the whole universe into unseasonable pralaya or dissolution. Since all exists only in his light, in his sight. In penance for this, she had to descend and undergo austerities on Arunachala before again being taken back as an integral part of Shiva. These old myths are not always easy to interpret. According to Hindu teaching, a phase of manifestation of the universe is exceeded by a phase of dissolution when all is gathered back into undifferentiated uniformity. Uma, the consort of Shiva, known also by other names such as Durga, Parvati, or Kali, according to the role she has to play, signifies the divine energy or the world. It is this which creates, but also, since all creation contains within itself the seed of destruction, all growth of decay, all birth of death, it is she who destroys and brings on the pralaya. During the pralaya, the divine energy is no longer manifest, no longer the consort of Shiva. but undergoing purification for a new cycle of manifestation. After completing her tapas, it is said that Uma went round Arunachala on the full moon night on the month of Kartike and was reassumed by Shiva. And it is in commemoration of this that the beacon is now lit on the mountain peak every year at this date. In the course of her tapas, Uma had to fight and slay the demon Mahishasura, who attacked her. This she did in her aspect of Durga. This fight with the force of evil is commemorated by Khadga Tank and Papanasa Lingam beside it. That is by the lingam that destroys sin. A figure of Mother Durga standing in victory over the head of the vanquished Mahishasura is to be seen.
Mahishasura
is to be seen in her temple next to Pavarakuna. This place is very popular among those who have boons to be granted. At this Pavarakuna, also Bhagavan resided for a while as a young man. And there is a Sri Chakra in the Durga temple, which he held in his hands during consecration in the temple. Further around the hill, then Gautama Ashram and the tank of Mother Uma is the ancient village of Adi Anamalai. Here is a beautiful and sacred old temple. People walking around the hill often go and worship there. Here is the temple of Sri Manikavachakar, author of the Titarvachakam, one of the most ecstatic of the Tamil poets. Coming around to the east side of the hill, we come to the temple and shrine of a much more modern Swami, that of Isanya Deshika Swami, who lived about the 18th century. He was a saint of great power who is said to have had Ashtama Siddhis waiting to do his bidding. I mean by the 8th siddhis. He is said to be a very, very benevolent and to bestow his grace not only on Hindus but on Muslims and Westerners also who pray at his shrine. The path around Arunachala is very sacred, as one sees the many varied aspects of the hill on going around. One finds that the hill itself is a Sri Chakra, the sacred wheel. There is scarcely a day or night without someone going around. Well, I can say that again. I mean, back then, you know, see the, other than the 64, you know, they wrote the... Some devotees go on a fixed day every week, some every full moon day, some for a regular cycle of 40 consecutive days, some indeed every day. Of course, there are particularly auspicious occasions for the pradakshina, the most outstanding of these being Shivaratri, the night of Shiva, and Kartike, the night when the beacon is lighted on top of the hill. Holy in itself, the path is made more holy still by the great saints and rishis who have trodden it, even by Mother Uma herself, and in recent times by Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, who, as long as health and vigor lasted, often went round sometimes alone, sometimes with the whole body of devotees. It is said that the pilgrim is accompanied by an invisible host of devas and rishis. This outwardly, inwardly, the mountain path is the path laid down for us by Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, the path of self-inquiry, the path leading to the experience, I am the Atma. I am not the perishable body. How is this experience to become by? By the grace of the Guru. So the Guru is both the way and the goal. Arunachala is open to all, on whom its grace has descended, and is the same as Ramanachala, by Sri Ramana Arunachala cut the knot of our primal ignorance and led us by his path to our final goal. Bhagavan in the Heart, from a record kept by Ethel Merston. I was torn as to whether to return to Europe to see my friends and relatives after 9 years of absence, or whether to stay on with Bhagavan. I could not make up my mind. In the end, I put the question verbally to Bhagavan himself. I sought him out on the hill during his morning walk, and he replied in English that destiny decides where the body shall go. I couldn't. But my real nature always stays everywhere with me wherever I am. So be in it. Wherever you are, remember Bhagavan, is there in your heart. Bhagavan is there in your heart watching over you.
Which year is this?
64.
64.
Fighting Sleeplessness by D. Not by me, Dennis. No. I was powerfully drawn to Bhagavan, his teaching. When I read about it, spoke direct to my heart, and I felt that it was the only way for me. When I came to his ashram at Tiruvannamalai, I felt great peace there. Not an idle, sleepy peace, but vital peace with great beauty. Only one thing distressed me, that whenever I sat in meditation, as we call it, inquiring into the reality of me, as Bhagavan taught, an overpowering wave of sleepiness came upon me. The annoying thing was that I gave up meditation and started to do something else. The sleepiness left me. The annoying thing was that if I gave up meditation and started to do something else, the sleepiness left me. I asked one of the older devotees about it, and he explained that this was just one of the ego's defenses against meditation. What he said was, normally, when we stop thinking, we go to sleep. But the sort of meditation Bhagavan teaches involves suspending thought while still retaining consciousness. The ego fights against it in two ways: by introducing thoughts, even though we decide to stop them, or by giving up consciousness along with them. That is to say, by going to sleep as soon as they stop. We simply have to persevere and resist both. I took this advice, and after some time, the attacks of sleepiness ceased to trouble me, and I found that it really was possible to remain awake, but undisturbed by thought, if only for a short time. I'm writing this now with the idea that it may be of help to other beginners who suffer from the same difficulty that I did. It seems appropriate to mention one or two old devotees who have passed away. We still occasionally receive inquiries about Yogi Ramaya on account of the high praise bestowed on him by Paul Brunton in A Search in Secret India. He passed away in 1962. He came of a simple agricultural family in Andhra and had no higher education. He approached Bhagavan for spiritual guidance in the early 20s, before Bhagavan was widely known, and remained a staunch devotee ever after. He made considerable use of pranayama, breath control was Bhagavan permitted in certain cases, although he did not actually prescribe it. It was for his benefit that Bhagavan translated his Upadesaram and Uladu Narapadu into Telugu, as Yogi Ramaya did not speak Tamil. A man of generous disposition, he gave freely to religious causes. He contributed liberally to the ashram in its early days. M.V. Ramaswamy Iyer was a retired engineer. He met his great-grandson in Virginia, you know, at that program we went to on the 15th. Yeah. He didn't know a lot. Somehow he knew about this program. He came and he told me on his phone he had the song Saranagati. So my great-grandfather wrote this, so if I ever get disturbed or something, I usually just play it, he says, on my phone. But he wasn't too connected to the ashram or anything, but he had that still, you know, doesn't leave him something there in family tradition. But he was enthusiastic at that program. He was a retired engineer and a gifted musical composer who first came to Bhagavan as early as 1909, when Bhagavan was still living in Virupaksha Cave. He followed Bhakti Marga, the path of devotion, worshipping Bhagavan as God. Some of his songs are very popular, especially the one called Sharanagati, Surrender. He passed away 2 years back. And N.S. Ranganadiyar, I guess, of the Tiruchanapalli Bar, some lawyer, who passed away a few years ago, was a diligent student of the Bhagavad Gita and his commentary by Sri Shankara. His deep Advaitic understanding drew him to the feet of the Maharshi, to whom he surrendered himself. He was of great help to the Sarvadikari in the work of ashram management, and also in the founding of the Sundara Mandiram at Tiruchuri, the Maharshi's birthplace, and of the Sri Ramana Mandiram in Madurai, the town where Ramana was living when he attained realization as a schoolboy of 16. He managed this latter institution until his death. His whole family are devoted to Bhagavan, who is, for them, the Supreme Lord. Renda Rao served Bhagavan for more than 30 years. He was a tireless worker in the ashram kitchen during the 30s and 40s. He also had knowledge of Ayurvedic medicine. When he passed away a few months ago, the ashram lost a devoted and sincere worker. Swami Rajeswarananda passed away quietly, suddenly, and unexpectedly at Sri Ramanashramam January 31st this year. He had been the editor of the Call Divine since its inception, 12 years ago. For the past 2 years, although, it continued to be published in Bombay. He had been resident here and edited it from here. Born in Madras, he was early drawn to a religious life and approached the Ramakrishna Math and its president, Swami Sarvananda, inspired by contact with whom he took the name of Satchitananda. Later, however, while traveling in North India, he was initiated into formal sannyas by Swami Sivanandaji Maharaj, known widely as Mahapurusha Maharaj. That was the, you know, disciple of Ramakrishna. This is all still the Ramakrishna order. He became the president also, who was then the president of the Ramakrishna order and was given the sannyas name of Rajeshwarananda. After becoming known as a writer, editor of periodicals, and Swami, he came to Tiruvannamalai to seek the grace of Bhagavan, whose devotee he remained thereafter. Here's just one line from Mirabai. Woo poverty. It is a great matchmaker between you and God.
Poverty is a
matchmaker. for getting married. To God.
We're already married.